Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 9th already of September. This hour of the program, we're going to be speaking with distinguished visiting lecturer at Syracuse University, David K. Johnston. He's a really interesting guy. We had him on a few months ago talking about his book. Today we're going to be looking at the president's plans for letting the Bush-era tax cuts be cut off for the wealthiest Americans. He also rolled out a trio of new plans in Cleveland yesterday to help spur job growth and to invigorate the national economic recovery, which isn't going very well. It would permanently extend a research and development tax credit that lapsed in 2009, allowing businesses to write off 100% of their investments in equipment and plants through 2011, and also put $50 billion into highway, rail, airport, and other infrastructure projects, which he proposed here in Milwaukee on Monday. David has, and this is an interesting thing for you to think about, he wrote an interesting piece recently on asking you to think about this question. How would you invest $1 billion under the current tax system? Where could you put your money? What would be best for that $1 billion? David is a former tax reporter for the New York Times. And as I said, he teaches at Syracuse University Law School. He is the author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. He's also the author of Perfectly Legal. And he has also worked for the San Jose Mercury, the Detroit Free Press, the LA Times, and the Philadelphia Inquirer before joining the New York Times in 1995. Here's our phone number. I expect we'll get a lot of calls on this issue this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email address, as always, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, David. Thanks again so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on, Kathleen.
Yeah, a great pleasure. Well, let's talk about the week and what the president has outlined here. What about this idea of letting those tax cuts for the wealthiest be cut? It's creating, obviously, quite a bit of a stir. Would it be great for the economy?
Well, it certainly would be better for the budget in the long run. Remember that the Republicans, when they adopted the tax cuts in 2001, did it through something called the reconciliation process. That's the very thing that they denounced over the Obama health care plan.
Mm.
And under reconciliation, the tax cuts could only last for 10 years. Now, there was a period, you'll recall, during the last decade when the Republicans controlled the White House, the Senate, and the House. Did they make the tax cuts permanent? No.
Mm.
Because they didn't have the votes among their own members in order to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we look at this thing, it's important to keep in mind that this is what the law plans. Now, Obama is proposing to retain those tax cuts that affect the first $250,000 of income, taxable income for a family. So that's more like $400,000 to $600,000 of total income. And even if you're a very high-income person, you will continue to get some of those reductions that fall on the bottom 97, 98% of the population. If we don't do this, the government, in essence, will be borrowing money to make up for the revenues it won't get. And in the last decade, under the Bush tax cuts, the amount of money that was borrowed to finance those tax cuts, because they did not pay for themselves. Government individual income tax revenues are actually smaller when you adjust for inflation in 2007, and that's a peak year in the economy, than they were back in 2000, the previous peak year. That borrowing was $2.4 trillion, and the interest on $2.4 trillion turns out to equal all the income taxes that you and I, everybody listening to the show, and everybody else in America paid in January and February of this year.
Hmm. The debate here is going to be pretty loud. It already has been, and it's very, very political. There's news this morning that the president has not, I don't know if this is a story or much in it or not, that he would not veto this legislation should they be allowed to be carried on. But it also seems that it's not going to be acted on before the elections, which are coming up pretty rapidly. Is this going nowhere? Is it not going to be acted on before the elections?
Well, both parties are playing sort of a game of chicken here. The Republicans are expecting, because this has happened, I believe, every time in the when we have a new president 2 years after he's elected, that his party loses seats in Congress. The Republicans are hoping that they will get a majority, and if they do, they will no doubt pass legislation making the Bush tax cuts, at least extending them, and perhaps doing more. On the other hand, if they don't have control, the risk that they run is that were the Democrats to gain seats, and that's highly unlikely, they might put through something that the Republicans would like even less. So, no, we're not going to see, I suspect, any vote on this until after the elections. And what you are going to see is the Republicans running against Obama and the president leading a charge against Mr. Boehner because he's trying to, you know, give people a way to personalize abstract issues by focusing on one person.
Mm-hmm. Is that wise? It must indicate that Boehner is not a very popular guy, huh?
Well, there was a poll that Fox News did earlier this year, the end of March or beginning of April, that they did not publicize. It was actually quite revealing. Remember, this is just before tax day. The person with the highest favorability rating in the country was President Obama at 50%. The second highest rating went to the Internal Revenue Service at 49%.
What?
Yes. The Tea Party came in at 36% favorability rating. Sarah Palin's rating was, and consistently this is what her ratings show, was around 24% favorable. And Mr. Boehner's rating was 12%.
Oh, my goodness.
But he did a little better among Republicans. Among Republicans, his favorability rating was 14%.
So that's why the president mentioned Boehner. This is why he had his speech in Cleveland.
Mentioned him eight times.
Eight times.
So there's no question what the White House has decided is the way to approach this.
Yeah. Is there, I've heard this before on this program from other guests, that somehow many of us believe that, well, one of these days we're going to be in that wealthiest tax tax level, and so we don't want to be taxed that much because you'd be taxing us. We're all going to get there eventually. And you would think that there would be a little bit of concern about the very wealthy getting off much better than those who are not very wealthy, and that's most people. But it doesn't seem to be that way. Or does it?
No, very, very few people are going to get in the top tax bracket. The top tax bracket in this country starts at about $400,000 of taxable income, which means that your adjusted gross income, that's the last line on the front page of your tax return, is probably in the neighborhood of $500,000 to $700,000 to get to that level of taxable income. The fact is that's less than 1% of the population of the country. The likelihood, therefore, you would get there is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 out of 100. But if you are 30 years old and have a career, you can pretty much take a look at your career path and see if it's likely that you're going to end up in that category. Here's another way, though, to think about this. The very highest income taxpayers, and that's an important concept, what I'm going to tell you, the very highest income taxpayers pay a smaller portion of their income to the federal government than the median worker. Half the workers in America make $514 a week or less. So let's round that. That's $26,000 a year. Half of all workers make less than $26,000. If you're a single person in 2008 and you made $26,000, you paid the federal government in payroll taxes and income taxes almost 22% of your income.
Mm.
But if you were in the top 400 taxpayers, these are people who made almost $1 million a day. They made $345 million on average. Your total federal tax burden was 16.6%. So a guy or a gal making $500 a week carried a much heavier burden than someone who made that much money every 20 minutes. And then on top of that, and this is not being discussed in this debate, the highest paid workers in the history of the world are hedge fund managers. We know that last year, 25 of them made $1 billion or more. One of them apparently made about $8 billion. What is the tax rate on hedge fund managers? Well, the news media consistently says it's 15%. That's half true. It's zero currently.
Zero.
That's right. When you cash out, you pay 15%. Well, these guys don't cash out. They reinvest. And if they need money to spend, they borrow. If you've got a $1 billion account, you can easily borrow whatever amount of money you need. And currently, you can borrow, if you're really well off, at about 2% interest, what you need. So you can live tax-free. So at least 25 people who made over $1 billion in 2009, and if they paid federal income tax on their hedge fund money, it was voluntary, because as long as they leave it in the account, their taxes are deferred into the future, and they get a 60% discount compared to, say, a book author, a surgeon, a movie star, a business owner who makes $400,000 of taxable income, because on the margin, that person is paying 35% plus, on top of that, the Medicare tax, which makes it almost 38%. And these guys pay zero now and 15% years later.
You would think that most people would be more than a bit upset about that.
But how could you be upset about it if the news media consistently misreports this and describes it the way the publicists for the hedge fund industry have explained it to them, because they didn't go read the law?
Well, they should do that. Because people should know what the truth is, right?
They should. And I have written in journalism forums and in other places, you know, that this is being misreported. It is a real fundamental problem. And this is true of a lot of things in our society. I mean, we live in a very, very complicated world. And with these cuts that have taken place in news organizations, the amount of time to really find out what's going on, as opposed to what publicity people tell you and want you to say is going on, has been changed a great deal.
Mm-hmm. You wrote a very interesting piece, and it ties in, and I'd like for you to tell us this story of, it ties into taxes right now. How would you invest if you happened today to get $1 billion put into your account? How would you invest this under the current tax system?
Right, and the one caveat, it assumes that you have all the money you want to spend. So you're not going to spend this. You're going to invest it and try to grow it. And the problem is that there are almost no opportunities to put your money to work. American businesses right now are sitting on $1.8 trillion of cash. Now, that's such a huge number. What's a trillion? Let me make it make sense to you. All the money held in cash and cash-like accounts by businesses in America, big businesses, equals $6,000 for every single person, every man, every woman, every child, $6,000. Are they putting that to work, investing it? Are they hiring people? Are they buying services and equipment and making the economy work? No, they're sitting on the money. Why are they doing that? Well, the reason they're doing that is that we have lots of supply. That's what that $1.8 trillion is. But we don't have demand. We have 14.5 million people out of work, a near majority of whom, or maybe just roughly half of whom, have been out of work for more than 6 months, mostly through no fault of their own because there are no jobs. And then we have another about 12 million people who are either working fewer hours than they want to work or have just given up because there are no jobs to be had in the place that they live. Well, that's the problem. We have this imbalance. And one way to think about the economy, you know, in the forest you have lichen, algae and fungi that live off each other. And if you get too much of one or the other, the lichen dies. In the same way, in your body, you have arterial blood flow and you have a venal blood flow. Well, if one of them is totally engorged and you have lots of blood going, say, through your veins, but your arteries are constricted, what happens? The blood begins to pool in places in your body. Eventually, it will begin to rot. And if you don't do something about it, it will kill you. So the question I raised, and I've since gotten back answers from my readers and from a lot of other people, including some very wealthy, successful businessmen and noted economists, what they would do with this money. And frankly, most of them said they'd put it in treasuries, that is, they'd put it in cash because they don't know where to invest it. A liberal economist suggested he put it into medical tourism, which is kind of offshoring jobs, one of the things
right.
he's against. a very successful Hollywood producer whose movies have consistently made a lot of money for investors said he'd invested in the time machine so he could go back and buy Microsoft. And if he means doing movies about that, I think I might invest money with him and not in an actual time machine. But basically, nobody had any ideas for how to really make money out of this except buying distressed real estate, because you can buy it cheaply now, and being patient, being willing to wait 10 or 20 years to make a profit off of it. That should tell us something about what's wrong in our economy, that what we're lacking is demand. And it isn't just jobs we're lacking demand in. The fact is most people don't have capital. They don't have resources that they invest. They are living paycheck to paycheck, even many people who have above average incomes. And so when this contraction came, suddenly you had all these problems that arose, and there's no indication we're getting out of them for a long, long time under the current policies.
So sitting on all of that money, no place to invest that money, people are not investing it in programs that would help lower the unemployment numbers or that would spark economic growth in this country.
Right. That's exactly right. And so then comes this idea that the president has put forth of, well, let's have these business tax cuts. Well, Kathleen, I also am the chairman of the board and founder and part owner of a small business, nothing little business, 25 employees. But I got to tell you, I want to hire more workers. I would like to put more people to work. But to do that, I don't need a tax cut because, like most small businesses, we don't pay any taxes in the business. If we have a profit, we either buy assets with it or we take it out in compensation. What I need are customers, and I need customers who can pay prices so I don't have to discount. Then I'll hire more workers. Get me more demand for what we're selling, and we'll gladly hire more workers.
So how do you do that?
Well, you have to have people have jobs and money in their pocket to spend so that they don't say to the kids, gee, I'm sorry, we can't go take you on vacation this year because, we don't have any money or we mm-hmm. don't have enough money this year.
And so perhaps the way to do this is to have a second stimulus bill and a huge stimulus bill to create jobs or not?
Well, indeed, I think that if Obama is a one-term president, if that happens, I think historians will look back and say that the principal reason was that he went for a much too small stimulus package, and 40% of it was devoted to small business tax cuts. The fact is we're right now looking at laying off. The latest figures I saw, and maybe they've changed, were as many as 300,000 school teachers. We are busy firing the most experienced and best school teachers because they make the most money, and of course, anybody who's in favor of saving money today by reducing the number of school teachers is really saying, I want us to be poorer in the future, because the most valuable asset we have is young minds, and investing in them so that they become more valuable. They are able to do the complex work of the world we're in now that's going to get more complex going forward, requires a significant investment in education, not a reduction in education. So that's one way. In the short run, yes. When there's a lack of demand, government makes up for that demand. A lot of people who think, this idea doesn't work, Keynesian economics doesn't work. Well, we've been practicing Keynesian economics in this country for a long time on a chronic basis. That's essentially what President Bush was doing. He just didn't call it that. You'll recall Richard Nixon said, we're all Keynesians now. Keynesian economics doesn't work as a chronic long-term plan. When there is a crisis, it works very well in getting money circulating through the economy so that you don't have these pools, as we do now, of rotting capital that are losing value.
Let's welcome phone calls for David. David K. Johnston is our guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. He is now teaching at Syracuse University College Law School and writes columns for Tax Notes and for The Nation. Our lines are all filled. Just keep listening, and eventually there will be an opening. We We'll give you the number again, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, and let's start with Rick in Prentice. Hi, Rick.
Good morning to you, Kathleen, and your guest. Just parenthetically, before I make my comment, I've studied economics virtually all my life. To me, it's my most fascinating subject, listening to a lecture by an economist. I went and talked personally to Dave Obey, the Democrat representative from up here, and I explained to him what was going to happen to the American economy, that it was going to collapse. I warned him about 9 months before it happened, and I pleaded with him to do something, and he chose not to. So essentially that's one of the main reasons we're in this fix, that the Democrat Party just doesn't give a damn about ordinary working people. But I tell you, the other thing is that I can't think of any historical example of a modern economy like ours that has high unemployment and high budget deficits where either one of these problems or the economy as a whole has been helped by raising taxes. Franklin Roosevelt tried this in 1936, and in 1937, the following year, we had a double dip of the Great Depression that lasted until about 1942. Clement Attlee, the socialist prime minister who took over Britain after Churchill was ousted, did the same thing. He believed in what he called socialist austerity, raising taxes on a battered economy, and the English economy didn't go anywhere either for a long, long time.
David.
Well, listen, in the long run, we have to balance our budgets. And since 1960, we've had only four balanced budgets. The last budget by Eisenhower, the last budget by LBJ, and the last two budgets by Bill Clinton. Okay? Other than that, we have been, Congress and presidents have been spending more money than they've taken in. It is one of the principal problems we have in our country right now. But let me give you an analogy about this. Imagine that you've gotten married and you both work, and there's an unexpected and you bought a house that requires two cars in order to get to work, and you suddenly have an unexpected pregnancy, and both your cars die.
Oh.
What do you do? Now, if you follow the reasoning that Rick has, well, you don't go buy and you don't replace your cars. That would require borrowing more money. And, of course, then you would lose your jobs, and you'll lose your house, and I don't know how you're going to get the money for the baby crib. What you do is you go borrow the money, that is, you incur an obligation against your future income so that you can keep the jobs you have and the health insurance you have and pay for the house you just bought and deal with this unexpected problem, but then you've got to pay it off as quickly as you can. And, by the way, that literally happened to me 40 years ago.
Oh, really?
That's why I understand this when I was a young man, and we went out and we bought two new cars. We paid one off in 18 months and the other one in 36. The average car loan in America today is, I believe, 60 months, which is an indication that demand is weak. Secondly, if we had not had this stimulus package, the arbiters of this, the Congressional Budget Office and the other people whose job it is to measure this and that both parties accept their numbers, say that unemployment right now would be much worse. Now, we're not talking about raising taxes on people in terms of their consumed incomes. We're talking about raising taxes here on people who have gotten this huge tax break over the last 10 years, and it did not pay for itself. It has put us deeper in debt. And by the way, there were no jobs created. There was a chart I did for The Nation a while ago that showed job creation by administration year by year since 1940. And the fact is that the worst period we had was during the Bush administration, where I think it should be clear at this point, he had a policy, it got a long-term test, it did not work.
So what did those people do with all their money?
Well, at the moment, a great deal of that money is sitting in treasuries and elsewhere. I mean, the federal government's cost of borrowing, its interest rate, today is less than half what it was in the year 2000. And what that tells you is that there's an enormous amount of capital out there with no place to go that is seeking safety, and so it's being put into government notes. And eventually, those interest rates will go up, and they'll be tremendous. This year, interest on the national debt, which is not all paid in cash, but interest on the national debt, equaled all the income taxes people paid through June, the middle of June. If we go back to the year 2000 interest rates, which are sort of the normal kind of interest rates we've historically had, you would have paid all your income taxes until Thanksgiving just to equal interest on the national debt. So there's no question we need to get the national debt in line. On the other hand, we need to think about what are we spending our money on? The single most important factor is what do we spend our money on? In my next book, one of the stories I'm going to tell is a very clear example of raising taxes that actually leaves people with more money in their pockets. And I know that's hard to believe, so I'm sure there are viewers saying that's not possible. Actually, it's very simple. All you have to do is have the government buy things more cheaply than you can individually. And you can pay more in taxes and have more money in your pocket.
When's the book coming out?
Sometime early next year.
Okay. Rick, thanks for the call. We go next to Dan in Three Lakes. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. Leaving the current tax rates in place for those who make over $250,000 per household or $200,000 per individual, isn't that just another dose of Reagan's trickle-down economics? And isn't it a fact that there is no empirical evidence that this spurs the economy? And wasn't the last guy who left us with a surplus Clinton, and didn't he raise the capital gains rates from 25% to 28%? And I'll listen off the air.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
Well, some things are right and there's some not. Let me deal first with the last point. Clinton raised taxes on the highest income wage earners from 35%, the rate we had then, to 39.6%, and got balanced budgets by also restraining spending a great deal. He signed a bill that cut taxes on capital gains. And here's a little known fact that I dug out of the record some years ago. The top 400 income taxpayers in America got a 60% bigger tax cut under Bill Clinton than they did under all the Bush tax cuts combined. Yes. Because, and this is all just, you can calculate it out of the official data at the IRS website. This is because people at the very top get so much of their income from capital gains. So if you're one of the, you know, people who make around $1 million a day, Bill Clinton was a better friend to you than George Bush in terms of cutting your taxes. I have argued that what we've seen is not trickle-down economics. That's a phrase that was invented by opponents of Mr. Reagan for his tax cuts that primarily benefited people at the top. What our tax system is actually doing is Niagara up. It is redistributing money upward. And my book, Perfectly Legal, lays this out and explains how this is happening. We've created a system that is moving money up to the top. The bottom 90% of Americans' incomes today, when you adjust for inflation, are lower than they were in 1973. Since 1961, the top 400 taxpayers have gotten each $73 more of after-tax income for each dollar that went to people in the bottom 90%. And when you adjust for inflation and taxes, the bottom 90% today get $1.20 income for each dollar that each person got in 1961.
And at what point in American history, Dave, was the tax bracket for those who make the most the highest?
During the Eisenhower years, it was as high as 91%.
91? Whoa.
That's right. You had to be single, and it was capital income. And by the way, I don't think that's a wise policy, all right? But curiously, if you plot job growth and GDP growth against the top marginal tax rate, the greatest growth actually occurred when we had the highest rates. And the point of that story is that marginal tax rates are a nice, simplistic political issue, but taxes are a much more complex subject. The Laffer curve, which shows correctly that at 100% tax, the government makes no money, and at zero tax, it makes no money, is not the nice, smooth, sloping line that Mr. Laffer sells. It is instead rather like a ball of yarn a cat's been playing with. It's all over the place.
Jim in Stillwater, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Good. I just wanted to comment, when we talk about the top 400 taxpayers or the guy that makes $500 a month, those aren't going to solve the problem on either end. You know, it's the extreme, and it looks nice in print or in something like this. my wife and I make $350,000 a year, so we're, quote, the rich. We pay over $10,000 a month in taxes. I don't get to claim either one of my children as a tax deduction because I make too much money. So I want to know, we're not going to solve this problem by taxing the top 400 that make $1 billion a year. There's too few of them for the solution. The solution is we need to stop fighting two wars. Why doesn't anybody focus on where we're spending the bulk of our money? China's prospering, India's prospering, and Brazil's prospering because they're not fighting two wars. It's pretty obvious.
David.
Well, first of all, let me point out something, Jim, you probably don't know. I'm in the same situation that you're in. You're under the alternative minimum tax. That is a Reagan policy that took away your deductions for your children, your home mortgage, your state income taxes in order to finance tax cuts for people at the very, very top, as I explained, in Perfectly Legal. And then under President Bush, that little bit of extra money, well, you and I, it's relatively a little bit, to the government, it's billions of dollars, is specifically earmarked to finance the tax cuts for people at the very top. And Jim is correct that the examples I gave of the $500 a week worker, not a month, and the $1 million a day plutocrat, those are extremes. I thoroughly agree with him. If you look at the federal budget, not the way the government presents it, but reanalyze it, you will find that half of the federal spending in this country is for the military. And that is not productive spending. It is not spending that adds wealth. And the cost of these two wars, which, by the way, I don't like calling wars. Congress has not declared war. We have not had a Congress declare war since December 9th, 1941. These two very expensive undeclared wars certainly are a major factor in the economic problems that we're having. There's absolutely no question about that. And so on that point, I think Jim is quite right.
What about a possible peace dividend as we are withdrawing some our combat forces from Iraq? Will there be money available?
Well, part of the problem with this is that the overall military budget is not really declining. And remember, there are huge deferred costs. You know what the peak year of personnel spending was for World War II?
No.
1994. 1994 was the peak year of personnel spending because you have retirees, medical benefits, et cetera, for people in war. And the ratio in battle of casualties to deaths has changed dramatically. Lots of soldiers who would have been killed and died in the battlefield in the past are now surviving. That's why the death number is actually quite small for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan compared to the level of violence. Well, those soldiers, in many cases, will be lifelong supported by the taxpayers, and their children will get benefits. I actually went to college under the GI Bill because technically I'm a war orphan. My dad was 100% disabled veteran of World War II, and there are children not yet born who will go to college in the future because their fathers or mothers became disabled because of these two wars. We're going to be paying for these wars when our kindergartners have gray hair.
Jim, thanks for the call. John in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I have three tax suggestions. Two of them serious, one not so serious. One, if you look at the Dow Jones, it does about 5 billion shares a day. And part of that is speculative investing that has caused some of the problems we've seen today. If you just put a penny tax on every share traded, and assume 250-day trading days a year, you could generate $10 billion a year. If you did a dime tax, it would be $100 billion a year. And that doesn't include the NASDAQ. I think that they're part of the problem. They should be part of the solution. My second suggestion is the Defense Department, if you think of their budget, or if you think of the Defense Department as homeowners insurance, what they're doing is they're protecting our assets. If you have homeowners insurance, if I own a bigger house, I pay more for my homeowners insurance. I think what they should do is create an asset tax, which includes corporations, and we add up what the assets that everybody owns are. And by assets, I mean major assets like houses and stock that we own, and then do an asset tax to fund the Defense Department. And then it would be fairly equivalent to homeowners insurance. The more assets that I own that need to be protected, the more I would pay towards the defense of that. And then my third suggestion is many people have a problem paying income tax, yet I see them going down to casinos and throwing their money away. I suggest to the IRS that they should give out lottery tickets for the more you pay in income tax, so that as people are paying their income tax, the more they pay, the more lottery tickets they get, and then they have a lottery at the end of the year.
Oh, John, I like your thoughts. David?
Well, there are actually historical precedents to these points. The first one about taxing transactions, there's a thing called the Tobin tax that tax economists generally think actually would be a very efficient thing to do, but Wall Street is dead set against a transactions tax. The caller is exactly correct that there's this enormous amount of computer-driven trading going on that is designed to capture anomalies in the stock market. And by the way, it's all financed with borrowed money from the big banks. One of the reasons we had to do the bailout had to do with the borrowed money, the hedge fund structure, which is about 30-to-1 ratio of equity to borrowed money. But the Tobin tax idea of taxing transactions, especially those that are quick turnaround transactions, is a good policy idea that has no political support. On the idea of wealth in the budget, you know, that's how we got the estate tax. It was argued by a man named Seligman, who was the leading tax economist of the early 1900s, that the conscription of young men to fight in Europe should be matched by the conscription of wealth, and that what they were doing was protecting wealth. And this is an idea we've lost a lot of sight of. The moral basis for progressive taxation, which is what gave birth to democracy in ancient Greece, is that there is no wealth without the state, without civilization. And therefore, the greater the gain you are able to achieve, whether it's luck or hard work, the greater your obligation to support the civilization that made your gain possible. Now, that's a 2,500-year-old idea that has survived and is therefore profoundly conservative, but you won't very often hear it from conservatives.
David K. Johnson is our guest. He is teaching now at Syracuse University in the law school. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning independent investigative journalist and former writer for the New York Times. He's also written for many other newspapers in the country. He is the author of several books. He's writing another one right now. He's author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Here's our phone number, 800. John, thanks for your call, 800-486-8655. There are two lines open for you right now. And the email address, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we were reading the current issue of Mental Floss magazine. They have an interesting story on seven tiny books that packed a big punch. Listed as number one on their seven tiny books is Common Sense by Tom Paine. And it got us thinking again about Tom Paine. And a professor from the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, Harvey Kay, who's written a great book about Thomas Paine. So we thought that we would talk about Thomas Paine again. He's a worthwhile guy, huh? So that's after the news at 10 o'clock. 800-486-8655. After tossing all these money figures around, I'm beginning to think that $50 billion for repairing highways, rail, and airport and other infrastructure projects in the United States may seem rather puny. Is it, David?
To use a Yiddish word, it's bupkis. It's insignificant.
Insignificant.
Insignificant. And we have enormous infrastructure needs, and not just for the physical things you see, like roads and dams and bridges. The American Civil Engineering Society gives our infrastructure an overall grade of D, including, I think it's a D for dams. We will sooner or later have some more dangerous dam and bridge collapses because we're not taking care of our infrastructure. But we also need to be investing in the internet. You know, in Japan, the homeowners there can get an internet that is 100 times faster
Ooh.
Than most Americans can get. In France, a triple play package of a telephone, internet, and cable TV costs the U.S. equivalent of $38, not the average U.S. cost of $160 when you include taxes. and that internet is 10 times faster. It is worldwide calling, not just continent-wide calling, and it has many more TV channels, and they're from all over the world. If we would build and put to use a serious internet the way we did with the Interstate Highway System, another big government program, or the Transcontinental Railroads, another big government finance program, we would see some studies, I think credible studies have shown, as many as 25 million jobs created within 10 years.
Oh, my goodness. So we're really, why are we so far behind? Why?
Because the existing oligopolies, one in cable and one in telephones, have economic models that maximize their profits by providing this lower grade of service. They minimize risk and maximize profit. And therefore, they're behaving in a way that makes sense under the regulatory rules that we have. Unfortunately, the news media is, you know, spends more time telling you about Lindsay Lohan's than about how the regulatory system works.
I think every day of the people we would rather not hear from again, she may be at the top of the list. Who the heck cares? Let's go to more phone calls. Stanley in Augusta. Hi, Stanley.
Hello. I had one comment, and when he was talking about being small business, people don't need to keep buying more stuff because we all have everything we need. Most of us have already moved to a level where we're more than comfortable. And without some new innovation or something new, what do we need to buy? My question was, in your talking, you had initial introduction, you had compared this low-income person, including their FICA, which was Social Security and Medicare, with the upper-income person, where you also included Social Security and Medicare, and I grant that they are part of the tax system, but Social Security and Medicare are a problem unto themselves that I see needs to be handled, if not completely separately, at least with certainly some different thought patterns, and I would like you to discuss that, please.
Well, but if you just want to do income taxes, the person at $500 a week pays 9% of their income taxes. The person who makes almost $1 million a day pays 16.6%, because the Social Security and Medicare doesn't change the rounding of their income. That's not a very progressive tax structure, given the enormous extremes that are there. Without a question, we need to make some adjustments to Social Security, but if we had full employment, if we didn't have wage stagnation, Social Security would be a zero problem. The shortfall in Social Security over the next 75 years works out to be a tiny fraction of 1% of the GDP over the next 75 years. It's a very small problem. Medicare is a different issue. Healthcare, like warfare, has become technological and enormously expensive. We ration healthcare in this country very severely. One-sixth of Americans do not have health insurance. They can go to emergency rooms, but if you have a chronic disease, lung disease, cancer, diabetes, emergency rooms are of no value to you. You need chronic long-term care. We spend 17% of our economy, and we're on our way to spending 20% of our economy on this system. Our economic competitors are spending 12% or less. They have much better healthcare systems, and if you doubt that, go to the CIA World Factbook and read what our own government says about where we rank. You will see that by some measures, we rank behind Cuba in our healthcare system. We need to have a much more efficient and effective healthcare system, and I think the number one way to do that is to get it off the back of business. In my business, why do I have to spend time worrying about healthcare for the workers I provide health care for, the only full-time employees I have? Why is that my business at all? It isn't my business what cars they drive, what they spend their money on, but their health care is my business. And this is an accident of tax policy from World War II that we've never corrected.
Thanks, Stanley, so much for the call. Don from Madison, hi.
Good morning.
Hello.
The analogy of the circulatory or the vascular system of the human body that your guest made earlier is a good one. I thought of a different one. I thought of a children's teeter-totter, so that when one of the kids gets too much and the other is really light, the teeter-totter stops. Things don't happen. And exactly so with the economy. Things just slow down. And also I'd like to to mention my own bitterness at the phrase currently in use, free economy. It is hypocrisy at its very worst.
David.
Well, first of all, Don, thank you. I'm always looking for more analogies, and that's a terrific one, the teeter-totter, and I appreciate that, and believe me, I'm going to make use of it. The phrase free market, I think, is the one you were looking for. There is no such thing as a free market. Free market is a term that has it's a term of art for economists, just like rent. Most people think of rent as what you pay a landlord. Rent to an economist means benefits you're not really entitled to, where you're getting too much money for the economic contribution that you're making. And all markets are regulated. So I've argued that there are two kinds of markets. There are competitive markets and there are rigged markets. But everything is regulated. Baseball is a fun activity, but it's trivial. And yet baseball regulates right down to how many stitches are on the ball and what color the yarn is. So what we've done in America and what these campaign contributions have been buying in Washington for years and years and years is a set of regulatory rules that are redistributing income upwards, restricting competition, earning rents, that is, income that you really shouldn't get in a competitive market, and damaging the economy in the long run. That's the issue my next book will be examining in detail through the bills you pay every month.
Thanks, Don. Bob in Milwaukee, hi.
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 A couple of years ago on NPR, I heard a story about by an economist where he talked about the fact that giving tax breaks to stimulate the economy actually gives the rich incentive to put money in their bank accounts, whereas raising taxes gives them the incentive to make the investment to defer the taxes, to grow their business, to pay their employees better, because that way they get something at a reduced rate, as opposed to, say, if you're in a 70% tax bracket, it's only costing you 30 cents to make capital investments, whereas if you are in a 30% tax bracket, it costs you 70 cents to do the same thing. I'll take my comments off the air. Thanks.
All right, thanks.
Well, it's even more complicated than that. I mean, frankly, you can show, if you make certain assumptions, that the best tax on capital is zero, because that will produce more capital, which should produce more consumption in the future. But that assumes, and this is an important assumption, that that capital is put to work in a productive way. Without a doubt, we have created a system that is encouraging people to build up unproductive capital, invest in unproductive things, as we've seen with housing. Housing prices cannot exceed more than about three times median incomes in any market, because people can't finance mortgages above that. To the extent that they have some equity in the homes, the house might be worth more, but mortgages can't exceed about 2.5 to 3 times, depending on interest rates, mortgages. And we have markets where it's 7 times, and those prices have to fall. We certainly want the tax system to raise money in the economy to finance the public goods on which private wealth depends: education, infrastructure, civil justice system, et cetera. And discourage withdrawals from that system that become unproductive.
And thanks very much for the call. But before the hour, which is rapidly going away here, your great guest goes away, how do people get 1/10 of the information that you have about all of this?
I've had the good fortune that the New York Times for 15 years paid me to think about these things and accepted my premise that we should try to think deeply about them. Tax.com is a free website run by Tax Notes, whom I write for, a nonprofit, non-advertising publication that does about 250 pages a week of serious tax journalism. Tax.com is one place where you will find ideas to think about this.
Okay.
But it is difficult, without any question, and unfortunately most of the news coverage is based on what politicians say, which often has little to do with reality.
Yeah. So tell us, David, in the minute or so that we have left, how should we get out of the mess that we're in economically?
Well, we need to be investing in the future, and we need to be creating jobs in the private sector. And the way that we do that is through a tax system that doesn't reward unproductive investment. Real estate is incredibly heavily subsidized. And if you are a major real estate family and you're paying income taxes, you should sue your lawyer for malpractice. we need to create a system, a tax system, that says invest, and that means things like these trade agreements that are basically designed to allow American manufacturers to move offshore, pay lower wages for goods they know they're going to sell back into the United States. We need to reexamine. That's not to argue against free trade. It's to argue against rigged trade.
Mm.
And let me just leave you with a quote, if I can, if we have time, from,
oh, yes.
From the middle of the 1900s, okay, 1860s.
Okay.
Labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not existed first. Labor is the superior of capital and deserves much the higher consideration. Now, that sounds like Karl Marx, right?
Yeah.
Abraham Lincoln's first
Abe.
State of the Union address.
Oh,
the greatest
Abe.
Republican president.
Oh, yeah, he was my guy. David, you're just a wonderful guest. I love these hours because all you do is you think. You're thinking the whole hour and thinking about things you did and learning things, too. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Our guest this hour, David K. Johnston. He is now teaching in law school at Syracuse University. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, spent 15 years with the New York Times, concentrating on taxes. He's the author, and we talked to him about this book, of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Once again, he recommended that you go to tax.com, where they write hundreds of pages each week about taxes in the United States and elsewhere. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for your calls, everybody. We'll return following the news.